Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, social critic, and mentor, navigating the messy art of living in the complex beauty of relationships. Through these conversations that we need to have, but often shy away from. It's another Tuesday, Elizabeth. Where are we off to today?
Good afternoon, Don. It's nice to see you. I am thinking a lot about my grandmother today. She was in my dreams last night. Two things, and I know there's a deeper thing to this, but I have to say it out loud so I can remember it later. At some point last night, a dire wolf entered my experience. So my grandmother and a dire wolf, I don't know if all in one, but together. But of course, hearing about people's dreams is as exciting as hearing about their travels. So I'll leave it there. But I think about my grandmother because when I was growing up, she would quite often lament how sad she was for the world that her grandchildren were going to be inheriting and that all of the great things had passed and there wasn't anything to look forward to. And she just was glad that she was getting old and would be leaving because she just couldn't stand to see what a sad, sad place that was going to be left behind. And I think about that often, one, because I had a wonderful time growing up and I continue to have a fairly wonderful time with the people in my life and the things that I've been able to experience. Also clouded by things that are really awful that we all are aware of. But my grandmother kind of failed to realize the things that she grew up experiencing, like the Spanish flu and the Great Depression and World War II and, you know, great social unrest in the 60s. I mean, there was a lot of polio. There was a lot of horrific things that she experienced in her lifetime. And yet she looked at the world through this lens of all of the beauty that she experienced, and the things that were changing just felt too sad for her. And not in specifics of the things that she was losing, because it wasn't environmental things, but more way of life things and, you know, the traditions and traditional families and the manners. You know, those are the things that she really felt were important for maintaining civility. And so I think about myself now as a grandmother and, you know, what I see for my grandchildren as their future. And I find myself needing to bite my tongue or, fight this, this not even desire, but this voice in the back of my head that is feeling those same things. Oh, I feel so sad for my grandchildren. Look at all the things that they're not going to get to experience that I did. And this is more environmentally connected or climate, you know, connected or even economically connected. But for whatever reasons, I hear that voice in the back of my head and it pulls me up short because it doesn't serve them and it doesn't serve myself because my grandchildren are growing up in the world that they see. This is their reality. They don't know what they're missing. They didn't know the world in 1950 as my grandmother didn't know the world in 1980 as I did. They know the world as it is now, and the joy in their lives and the things that they experience and the places they love to go and look forward to outdoors, you know, in their day-to-day, adapting to what is their reality is still full of promise. And although it's different than the promise we expected, go to college, get a good job, buy a home, have a family, it's going to be a different story, just like it was for my grandmother seeing the different story when I moved in with my husband before we got married, clutched the pearls, oh my goodness, where it's all falling apart. Not to mention that most of the grandmothers all got pregnant before they got married, but didn't talk about that, right? It changes. Every generation has their oh my goodness moment. But what my grandchildren are looking forward to is all the potential of their full experience as human beings on the planet. And so I've been thinking a lot about how do we move away from this hand-wringing, it's all coming to an end perspective and try to embrace and open ourselves to the possibilities for the generations that follow us, because I don't want to be the cranky old person that kind of, you know, makes everyone's life miserable at Thanksgiving. I want to embrace and feel a part of all the things that they're excited about. I might not understand how cryptocurrency works, but I know the son-in-laws do, so they have a great conversation. I might not understand how a 3D printer makes a house, but somebody's figured it out, so why don't I just go along for the ride and enjoy that experience as well? And I certainly am not excited about AI taking away all the jobs that we felt were so important to be done by human beings. For me, I would be really sad if my children were talking to an AI bot about, you know, mental health issues. But again, who am I to determine the future for our children when it's all open and available to them in ways that they feel really excited? Lots of things will end. Lots of things will be different. They won't be riding in a cart down into a coal mine at 12 years old. So yay, that's changed in multiple generations, you know, but their idea of work might be totally different and it might be much better. Because let's think about this whole idea of work and productivity in the American dream that we have. It's very dependent on the Industrial Revolution. Because prior to that, we were mostly an agrarian communities, you know, where were cities and people lived in cities, but primarily we were agrarian and people lived on farms and they lived in multi-generational homes on homesteads or in apartment buildings with multi-generational families. And the idea that someone was going to own their own home, and then of course, before cars were even invented, that wasn't on the table. But even when cars came about, to have one car was considered glamorous. And so throughout the Industrial Revolution, all of the old ways that used to be died out. Gas lamps on the streets, horse buggies downtown, you know, the making room for cars, all of those changes. But along with the Industrial Revolution, the way we worked and spent time as a family also changed drastically. Because we went from having really no set times, there wasn't anything about a 9-to-5 or working the, you know, conveyor line or working inside a factory. That didn't exist. And yet we adapted to the 9-to-5, 5 days a week with weekends off. And we adapted to the school years because we didn't even have mandatory high school education until the 1920s. But we adapted and made space for high school educations to be a requirement for young people, which changed the course of history for generations to follow. And it's not that many generations back. We're really just looking since post-World War II, actually, that we saw the generations benefit from the opportunity to have a high school education and then to go to college. Like all of these things were happening very quickly. And then we saw that people's lives became about the American dream. We get a job. We go to work 9-to-5. We go to church on Sundays. We all live similarly in our houses and communities. Everyone is lockstep in, you know, how we behave. And it became very narrow. And then the goal was to save money so you can have a vacation. That American dream was very narrow in its setting, and it became the thing that everyone seemed to strive for. But it only really lasted statistically from 1955 to 1975. Only those 20 years. After that, people couldn't keep up with all of the ideals of the American dream because everything became more expensive or more out of reach. People started living more on credit, which we didn't even have families living on credit prior really to 1975 to the level that it does now. So my point in my story is that we lament the loss of this world as we knew it in the Industrial Revolution. And yet, for the good things that came out of it, and again, nothing is all bad or all good. There are always places that we've improved, and there's always places where we've lost. But looking at the culmination of the Industrial Revolution, it's gotten us to where we are today, and we're bursting at the seams, clearly. We're bursting at the seams on every front. And so what is the next revolution? What does that look like? And I, for one, want to be able to embrace that through the eyes of my grandchildren, the Gen Zs and the Alphas. They're really Alphas, the Gen Zs and the younger millennials. Not that I'm throwing away the older millennials, but they're pretty rooted in having followed a lot of that American dream, traditional college education, try to buy a house. And they're actually another show doing quite well. Although most of the conversations about the older millennials is how they were behind the eight ball because they graduated in 2008, but statistically, they're actually doing quite well financially, economically. So who we're talking about next are those lower millennials, the Zs and the Alphas. And how can we embrace and rejoice in the potential for the world that they're coming into so that they can rejoice and find great joy in what their life is going to look like and the story that they're going to live and that we're going to be able and hopefully be witness to, because the old folks are hanging around a lot longer than they used to. So if we're going to be hanging around at Thanksgiving until we're 85, 90 years old, then we need to change our attitude a little bit, because we're guests. We're guests in their experience of the world. We really aren't the ones shaping it. And so that's the conversation I want to have today. And I've invited a guest in who I would consider the younger of the millennials to kind of open up our hearts and talk about what we both see and to open up the phone lines to see what you are feeling or hear what you're feeling about the potential for the future and how can we put aside the lamenting and embrace what is, because that really is all we have. We have to embrace what is, because we can't put the genie back in the bottle, which is an overused cliche, which I just heard a little while ago, and now I'm using it again. But we can't, and we don't want to. I don't want to be my grandma or a dire wolf, or maybe I do because I'm not really sure what the symbolism is. But whatever it is, that's where we're going today. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist, and you will be part of our conversation as well. If you want to give us a call at 805-781-3875, you can always send me an email after the show to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Find me on Facebook and Instagram. Send me a message. I'm happy to respond. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org or Be Modern. And join the podcast. Just find us wherever it is you find podcasts, subscribe and leave a review, and you'll be able to listen at your convenience. So we're going to take a quick break and come back and start this conversation right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. When you move in right up close to me, that's when I get the shakes all over. Quivers down the backbone, I get the shakes in the knee bone, tremors in the thigh bone, shaking all over. And I'd like to welcome my guest today, Ara Costello. Hello, Ara.
Hi.
So, not a first timer here on the show. So, I appreciate you coming back and wanting to spend an hour with me.
So lucky. So lucky. Thank you for having me.
So, those of you who might not know Ara, she is a community organizer, a leadership coach, an artist, and activist in creating her connection to the living world. You've been very involved in the preservation or the attempted preservation of the oaks in Napomo, and as well as your work in other areas in the Central Coast. And I invite you today because I want a perspective from a different lens.
Okay, let's do it. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So where are you in your millennialship? Are you, I said you were earlier, younger.
Yeah, let's
millennial.
Say earlier.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, younger millennial.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So what is the lens, if that's not too broad, but how do you see your future unfolding for you? What are the things you're anticipating?
Uh-huh, yeah. Well, first, I just want to thank you for this prompt, for this question, because you're not the only one who has a voice in the back of your head that is definitely like, oh, we are in trouble. I have that voice too, and you inviting me to have this conversation awakened the balance point. And mm-hmm. So I was thinking as I was listening to your intro that I find so often in my practice that grief and gratitude go hand in hand. Mm. And so there's the grief, the mourning, the loss of what was, and then right there next to it is the gratitude of what is and what might be. Mm-hmm. And so what I see for myself is harmony with grief and gratitude. Another way that I could say that is to continue to deepen my equanimity, which is my essentially my presence and appreciation with what is, alongside the understanding that the only constant is change. Mm. That to be alive, to be embodied, to be in human form is to be changing. And what that means for us, of course, is as a, let's say, young millennial.
Yes.
I'm at the part of my life where I'm like, oh, I'm not going to live forever. You know, I'm aging. Oh my gosh, my body is changing. I'm dying, actually. You know, I'm very healthy. I'm very grateful for that. Let me just affirm that.
Your parents just got very anxious.
They're like, wait, what? Yeah. No, but you know, I'm going to die, and my parents are going to die, and my husband's going to die. We're all going to die. And things will continue to be born, hopefully. You know, I don't want to take that entirely for granted. But even if this entire planet was destroyed, let's say in a nuclear Armageddon, we're not the only planet in the universe. I think that's
a giant gratitude you're carrying.
That's a giant gratitude. There's an elder. His name is Arkan Lukshwala. He's an Andean elder from Peru who speaks. I heard him through the Pachamama Alliance a couple different times. And he reminds most of us, the Westerners who are listening, like, hey, you know, of course, like, we need to really honor the fact that we are children of the earth, of Mother Earth. And also, like, remember that the earth is not alone. The earth has friends and family, and so let's not essentialize. Even, you know, we talk about human supremacy, or this idea that we're the most important thing on the planet. Obviously not. But we're not even the most important planet. Yeah. We're not even the only planet. So I'll try to bring it home so we can go somewhere else, which is to say, I see in my own life and in the lives of the people around me and in the cultures that I participate in, an increasingly expansive awareness of reality that goes hand in hand with what I said, equanimity, so a willingness to be with the reality of change, which involves both grief and gratitude. So to welcome death and to welcome life and to embrace both.
I think what people struggle with most, and it's a common theme in psychotherapy as well, and we don't, you know, therapists try not to couch it in these terms, but in order for us to change and evolve as individuals, there has to be the death of essential parts of our identity, of how we once knew ourselves. And that's where most people get really stuck, is the idea that part of what they've known or how they've known themselves needs to die off for new things to occur. That concept feels really challenging.
Oh, of course. I mean, here in the West, right, speaking as an American, I was born in California, so are my parents. We don't have very many rituals, community rituals to support those transitions. And so we're often navigating them, even when we're together with our nuclear families, in a way that's very isolating. Mm-hmm. And that's not what we're designed for. We're designed to navigate those transitions in community and with the wisdom of our elders, not just going back one or two generations, but tens of thousands of generations worth of wisdom that we would inherit and get to enact and embody. So of course, I mean, we have to give ourselves the grace of that. Yeah, it's like super scary because we haven't been instructed in how to navigate death or change or loss. And still, that is our birthright, to be able to navigate that with grace. And that's what I see, because I love this prompt. What do I see in my life? I mean, it's already happening now. It's not an imagination, but a resurgence, a remembrance of ceremony. Mm-hmm. And whether it's through, you know, our family lines, like, you know, your grandmother in your dream, mm-hmm. Or my grandmother, who's fortunately still alive, telling me about the way things were and how they did stuff. You know, again, through waking life or through dreams, through visions, I see a remembrance and a recollection of these ancestral traditions, no matter where we're from, and a revival of them, so that we can accustom our nervous systems to navigating that necessary transition and change that is inherent to life.
Which makes the conversation a little more complex, because there's two things happening at once. We're talking about this respect for the elders and the ancestors for thousands of generations, and at the same time, not wanting the fear of the elders who embody the fear of things that they used to know changing. And so to me, that's the fine line between the two. change in our structure, our day-to-day, how we work, how we make money, how, you know, what we drive or if we drive, those very malleable parts of what it is to be part of a culture of civilization are always dying and changing and dying and changing how we do commerce, right? How we do economy. But the part that I think we're leaning into that's missing is then what's the through line? If we can't hang on to the cultural norms of hundreds of years that we're always going to wear hats and gloves out in public, right? We're going to hang on to, you know, how it is we do commerce. If those things we're not are constant, because that's why I think people feel so much anxiety, because they were leaning into those malleable things, changeable mm-hmm. things as they're constant. Because what's missing is the through line, which is the ceremonies and rituals that don't really change through generations and generations, right? How families care for each other and tend to each other and tend to the ceremony and the care for the earth. And so where our hanging on dearly for constancy is shifting underneath us, people, I would say, ideally are shifting or would be shifting to hanging onto the constants of ritual and change and ceremony. And maybe we see that in the rise of things like Turning Point USA or, you know, growing religious movements or the whole spirituality wellness movement as kind of a religion unto itself. Mm.
Yeah, this is so great because I am a meditator. And so actually this summer I sat my first long retreat. So it was 20 days of silence and no eye contact or really contact of any kind with anybody except for myself. I saw other people, but I didn't interact with them. So that was a long time mm-hmm. of being in the silence and really getting to witness what is changing and what is still there. So even what I mentioned, right, the ceremony, the inheritance of our human culture or our more than human relatives that can be transmitted through ceremony, through dance, through song, art, right? Mm-hmm. All that is also changing and dying. Mm-hmm. And so there is something deeper. And I think it's interesting you brought up Turning Point because I'm like, ooh, I'm feeling optimistic. I got a positive spin on things, you know? Like, am I going to be a member of Turning Point? Never in my life. Am I curious about any, and I don't know that this is true for Turning Point necessarily, but any genuine move towards asking what is real and what does persist amongst everything that changes? And for me, when we were talking about this in the lead up to this show, I see in my own life, I'm already living it, and I see it in the people around me, and I hope to see it more and more in the world, is a turning inwards, right? So going into these spiritual, they're really cultures, right? They're groups, they're places of belonging. And then there are principles and there are practices, and moving towards the mysticism in each of our traditions, which mm-hmm. inevitably leads us inward. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite practitioners, his name is Bruce Tift. He wrote a really, really great book called Already Free. He's a meditator from the Tibetan tradition and a psychotherapist. And so he talks about the underlying anxiety of our human experience is the ego's awareness that it is not in control and that everything that we're clinging to, which I would say is illusory, anything that we're clinging to that isn't, it's hard to put words to it, right? When you get into the mystical tradition, there is no more language there. Language comes after what persists, which is the I am. And there is solace there. There is peace. There is happiness, a kind of happiness that goes way beyond sensory pleasure that exists. And it's, again, challenging to describe because it precludes language. But every culture, every healthy culture on the planet throughout all time has talked about it or gestured towards it. So what I see is all this destruction that we're witnessing and all the suffering, that it pushes people to really have to go inwards and rely on themselves and see what is there for them. And you can call it God and you can call it the universe. You could call it Dhamma. You could call it whatever you want. It doesn't matter. It doesn't care what you call it. Mm-hmm. But there is that which persists is so big that it really will, it swallows everything, you know. It's like getting to be a drop that goes back into the ocean. It's the ocean. Mm-hmm. And the little drop is like, oh no, I won't exist anymore. What, I don't want to die, da 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 da. But if we can get comfortable with how that lives in the body, right, the sensations of that fear, then we can begin to move towards that oceanic awareness. Some people call that enlightenment. And in the enlightened state, even though there is change and deterioration, there's no more suffering. Even though there is loss, and even though there is pain, and even though there is death, there's no more suffering. And I think that's what we all want.
And the acceptance that there's grief and joy that happen together. If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Ara Costello. She's a community organizer, leadership coach, activist, artist, and clearly a deep thinker on all things spiritual and kind of our own experience here. Our number is 805-781-3875 if you'd like to be a part of this conversation with a reluctant therapist. So the question on the table was a bit twofold. You know, one was, what is it that the younger millennials and the Zs and the alphas coming up see as their joy in the world? What are they excited for? What are the kind of things that they're thinking about for work or family? And I was reading a few articles about kind of the Gen Z information. So here's a little overview. The Gen Z generation visualizes a future that prioritizes experience, purpose, and emotional well-being over other markers of success like material wealth and high status, while acknowledging and having anxiety about financial stability and debt. They are cautiously optimistic, focusing on personal happiness, strong relationships, and making a positive impact. And this whole thing is reflective in their desire to have experiences like traveling, their value of mental health, their emphasis on having purpose-driven work that aligns with their values and issues, and that lack of diversity and sustainability that they see. And so a lot of this Gen Z conversation kind of fits the tearing down or destruction that we see of our economic and social structures that we've been, you know, immersed in since the Industrial Revolution. We'll just start there. It goes further back, but that's a good starting point. Maybe all of this ending is actually a great beginning, and it's just the generations that are losing what was constant that are grieving. But for the Gen Z, it looks like their future, once they get over the pressure of, but wait, you're not following the story that you were told to follow, once they're able to let go of that and see, yes, but just as the Industrial Revolution brought, you know, men mostly off the farms and into the factories and into, you know, company towns and into a kind of wealth that they never imagined, what the Gen Z, alphas, younger millennials are facing will be a whole new definition. Because this idea of valuing and placing success around monetary success and having a home and buying a car, that is the story of two generations. It's not hundreds of years old. It's a small part. So what does this next future that prioritizes things that the parents and grandparents don't understand? What do you mean you're talking about your mental health? What do you mean that you don't want to work 5 days a week and you want to work 3 days a week and then be able to travel? What does that mean? Are you a bum? You know, that this is the messy part, right?
Yeah, I love this. I'm going to take us, I think, like a slight left turn, but it's on the road. It's on the path, which okay, is okay. What I hear through all of that, right, is the word that's coming up for me today is presence.
Okay.
Is this generation is recognizing that all of these external markers of success are ultimately crutches that some may be better than others, but the true wealth, the only thing that cannot be taken away from us no matter what happens, right? Because you could be in a car crash, your country could slip into an authoritarian regime, let's say, any number of things. There could be a global pandemic totally outside of your control. And ultimately, your experience of that comes down to what degree of presence have you cultivated in yourself?
What do you mean
by that? Well, for me, and it happens for in a lot of different ways, but it has come through my meditation practice, and that's really about sitting, being still, being quiet, and observing the sensations in my body, and practicing not reacting to them, and practicing having neither craving nor aversion. So what that really results in is practicing unconditional love towards reality as it is, not as I would like it to be. And that places me sometimes when I'm lucky in a state of presence. And the left turn that I wanted to make is that what I really see happening that I'm very excited about, I see it happening in my life, and I would love to see it happening in the United States, because that's where I'm from, is a total reconstruction, transformation, alchemization of our sense of time. So my degree is in philosophy. You're like, oh, you're a deep thinker. I'm like, you don't even know. our sense of time, right? This is a metaphor. Like, the way that we relate to time culturally is actually a metaphor, which is another way of saying it's a construction. It's something that's easy to take for granted. And in the West, the metaphor of time is very much, possibly because of the Industrial Revolution, but maybe it preceded that, is very much as if we're on some sort of conveyor belt and you can't get off, and you're just, you know, it's going in a straight line, and there's the past behind you that you can't change, and there's the future that's coming that, like, maybe if you're good enough, you can control to be, you know, tolerable for you and your loved ones, and
or immune to debt or pain or grief, right? Yes. All the things that's the promise of that bubble of the conveyor belt. You do all the right things and you will not have to suffer.
Right, which keeps us literally in line, right? Another figure of speech, but keeps us under control, right? Keeps us predictable. And I'm very interested now in this concept of time that I was looking up. I really hope this is the right citation. I believe his name is John Mbiti. I'm so sorry if that's incorrect. He's a Kenyan philosopher. He's no longer alive. He was writing a lot about African spiritualities. And then what's been most interesting to me recently is his discussion of the African concept of time. Yes, I recognize that's a huge generalization. He's Kenyan. He was doing a survey of, in general, from the African continent, what are the through lines about what time is. And I mentioned Archon Luke Swala already, the Peruvian elder. I heard him speak around the same time about the Andean concept of time. And even though they're using different words, they're borderline identical. And it's radically different from the metaphor that we use here in the West when we think about time and thus fit ourselves into that thought structure. So what I'm experimenting with, and it's hard and it's weird, is actually there really is no future. It does not exist, right? That's a construct of the mind. And so that, therefore, we're already engaging, feeding, you know, enabling the ego as soon as we invest in this concept of this future. And what does exist, though, is this present moment right now. And the moment, there's a concept, there's a linguistic concept, a language-based concept of the next moment, right? So we can talk about, like, I think I'm going to be still sitting here 1 second from now. I'm not 100% sure, but I think, okay, there's now and there's that next moment. And then actually it's the past that is eternal. Hmm. It's the past that is eternal. And in the Western metaphor, right, it's like we have our back to the past and that's behind us and you can never change it. And just, you know, don't look back.
Overcome it.
Yeah, overcome it. Don't look back. Don't look, you know, and just look to the future where you have some control, right? Mm-hmm. Which we're touching on is an illusion. You could do everything right. I have a song about this, which is I could buy a new truck and end up in a ditch. I could think this new truck is going to be the best thing ever. And that might be the thing that kills me. I don't know. I don't know when I'm buying it. It's not my intention. But so we think we have some control, right? And really what that means is that we are under control when we look towards the future, but the earth-based way, the old ways, the ancient future technology, the metaphor that is more functional about time is that we have our back to the future and we're facing the past where all of our ancestors are, where everything that's ever happened lives. And there we're supported and we can learn it and we walk backwards into the future. So that's from Archon Luke Swala and the Andean concept. And John Mbiti says something more like, you know, time is something that you either make or you wait for. It's not existing. It's not a flow that you're like, you could
guaranteed.
Waste. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that you could. It's not a commodity. So we make time in these ceremonial contexts, or I make time twice a day to sit and meditate. And we also can just wait. And there's a real peace in that. Is it the right time to reach out to that person? Is it the right time to get married? Is it the right time to have a baby? Just wait and see. And there's a humility in that that intrigues me.
My guest today is Ara Costello. I'm going to say philosopher from starting, from now to say philosopher, community organizer, leadership coach. It must be challenging because you hear all of the kind of straight commentary and your brain goes to like the more macro experience of it, which is fascinating. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875. We're going to take a quick break and come back and continue our conversation right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
We were born before the wind, also younger than the sun. Yeah, the bonnie boat was won as we sail into the mystic. Oh, I can now hear the sailors cry, smell the sea and feel the sky. Let your soul and spirit fly into the mystic. And where that foghorn blows, I will be coming home. Yeah, when the foghorn blows, I wanna hear it. I don't have to fear that I wanna rock your gypsy soul. Just like way back in the days of old.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist with my guest, Ara Costello, philosopher, community organizer, leadership coach, artist, and activist, and actively creating her connection to the living world. And so I'm going to pull you back into the place where we are, though, a little bit with the whole idea of the Gen Zs and their view of their future, which they're, you know, statistically, although they are very focused on mental health, and we talk a lot about their, you know, problems with social media and attention, and we really focus on all the ways the Gen Zs and now the Alphas are struggling. But the part we don't focus on, which is equally as compelling, is that they actually have priorities as a cohort. Not that they've come together and talked about it, but they do have priorities overall of experiencing their life from a place of purpose and emotional well-being and other markers of success rather than material wealth and high status jobs that they were taught was the way to, you know, protect themselves from all pain and suffering. They recognize the anxiety that they have about financial stability and debt. They see that as a huge weight moving forward, but they're also cautiously optimistic, focusing on their personal happiness and strong relationships and making a positive impact, and that also being able a way to create community and stability and financial stability in different ways. Like maybe we're in more of a communal way of living again and communal support, which again, as I mentioned at the top of the show, we lived in multi-generational families and more communities of leaning on each other than, you know, for thousands of years. We had this one moment of this Industrial Revolution that, you know, came into the single-family homes, everyone's fends for themselves, nuclear family, but it was a short-lived experiment. So maybe what the Gen Zs are doing, as you mentioned, they're not turning their back on the past, but they're actually allowing the past to come forward once again.
Yes, that's so beautiful because it actually, I can't speak for Gen Z, right? I'm not Gen Z, but I definitely really appreciate, I'm so grateful to hear that this is where they're at and this is what they're prioritizing and what mm-hmm. they're working with. And I think it's so beautiful, and I really want to honor, myself, first of all, as mm-hmm. a millennial, and then I want to honor my parents as like late boomers, and you, I think maybe you're early Gen X. I mean, yes.
Late Gen X,
boomer. Early boomer. We'll call that late Gen X.
I'm a cuspy.
She's a cusp. I want to honor your generation and the generations before that and before that and before that, because they have made it possible. Like the ones who have survived and who made that sacrifice of creating those bubbles of protection where they've been able to, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's not in a moral quality that they were able to do that. But to that me as a millennial and Gen Z and Alpha, that they even have the space, that they even have the sense of safety in their body to think about having emotional intimacy, mm-hmm. having emotional wellness or mental wellness, what kind of relationships they actually want, not just the relationships that they are told they have to have.
Which is interesting, right? Because a lot of the ancestors, my grandmother being one, would roll over in their grave thinking, this is what you did with all of our hard work and sacrifice. You're prioritizing your mental health and your purpose-driven life. Yeah. It's like, no, you were supposed to put your head down, your nose to the grindstone like we did and yeah. suffer. But instead, what you're saying is, this is all the gifts that have moved forward to yeah. having this moment. And yeah. is it just a privileged moment, though, really? Is it just this very small few that get to have this awakening? Or do you feel it's more universally possible?
I think it has to be universally possible. Mm. I think for those of us who do have the privilege, even if it's just one moment in one day, to dream about what it is that we actually want, that we need to really be present with that and to do our best to share it with our community and to make sure there's equitable access to it. And that's a whole other conversation. But it's reminding me right now, because I'm in this class with the Nonviolent Communication Academy, and is taught by this woman, Sarah Payton, another one of my favorites, called Healing Intergenerational Trauma with Nonviolent Communication. Okay, la la la. But it's so interesting because we're doing these exercises where we're really just for fun, but attuning to our ancestors, right? These people who, however they were in their life, whatever the state of their nervous system was, their soma was when they were in a human body, that now they've passed on. And so we attune to them. And so often, it's like people from all over the world, strangers, you know, people's lives I know nothing about, but I just get these glimpses. And over and over and over again, when we attune to these ancestors who have passed, even if they were the most like curmudgeonly, you know, scared, contracted people when they were alive, when they're liberated from that human form or from that constraint, and it might just be in our imagination, but I like this imagination, they're so happy for us. They're so happy. They're like, thank God I live my life in this state of fear, and it was terrible, and all I really wanted was to be happy. Right? I didn't really want a car. I didn't want 2.5 kids. I didn't want this particular outfit. All anyone on the planet wants is to be happy. And so often in this class, I'm getting to witness people attuned to their immediate ancestors or the ancestors who have passed further back down the line. And these ancestors, you know, speaking in this way are always like, oh my gosh, I'm so happy to see you thrive. And being more specific, yesterday I was in the workshop and I was doing this exercise, and we were talking about this woman. Her mom was super, super scared, always in her left brain, you know, very like logical. Why would you feel emotions? Yada, yada, yada. She was like that because her mother had a mental breakdown and was institutionalized and subject to shock treatments. And because that's the reality she was living in. And so she grew up knowing it's not safe to be vulnerable. It's not safe to demonstrate fragility, even if that's the reality, if that's actually what's happening. And so this woman was getting to work with that and recognize like, oh, that's not actually what they wanted for me. They didn't actually want me to be constricted and to cut myself off from my emotions. They wanted me to be safe. And this is the way that they thought that I could be safe, by teaching me that I can't be vulnerable. I can't fall apart. And I think what Gen Z is doing, those of that generation that have the space in a moment or a day or maybe their whole life, if they're really blessed, what they're doing is living those blessings.
But then there's the other part of me that says, yes, but,
yeah.
Because I'm the reluctant therapist.
I love it. Yeah.
I don't know. I understand the draw to, I want to live that authentic life. I also always have an issue with the goal of happiness. I would much rather use the term eudaimonia, living to my highest purpose and values, because happiness is such a shallow, you know, emotion, or it's been,
yeah.
So I usually cringe from that. But let's say living to eudaimonia, to our highest values and beliefs, and actually like resonating that level. My challenge a bit, though, with disease, if we don't do something concrete as the elder generation, something concrete that helps them take all of this desire to step into their emotional well-being, right, to their higher self, to their purpose-driven life, if we don't give them concrete ways to express that, I have some fear that they contract into the institution of mental wellness, right, that they become almost subjected to being trapped in this hamster wheel of the mental health industry,
yeah.
right? That their desire to have more awareness actually cripples them because they have no ability to do anything else except to tend to their mental well-being, their yeah. emotional well-being. That's, to me, the rub, and where the older generations have a space. You can't just turn, you can, but we shouldn't just turn backwards and say, you're doing it all wrong. Go to college, get a job, do what we did. But to say, things have changed profoundly in our culture. Things are changing rapidly. And I'm going to help you embrace that by helping to give you support in your desire to have different outcomes in your life and not be crippled by this belief that I always am a victim of my mental health. Because that's the saturated story. I can't because I'm depressed. I can't because I have OCD. I can't because I'm a highly emotive or sensitive person. I can't.
Right.
And that's crippling.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I so appreciate, because I've heard you say this more than once on different episodes of your show, we need to differentiate right between the industrialized mental health field versus actually community care that's oriented towards the well-being of individuals and of all of us, right? So I would say I'm coming from a spiritual perspective, and I'm saying that, okay, if someone is narrating like that, I know right away that they're not actually engaged in peace and presence. And so I would question, what are the modalities that you're engaged? Are they working? What have you seen? What benefit have you received from those modalities in your life?
And they would say, I don't have symptoms.
And I would say, well, okay.
Is that living, though?
Well, I mean, I'm not, I'm trying to be concrete, but as the philosopher, I'm like, girl, we can have a whole conversation. The diagnostic model itself is a metaphor that we take for granted. Okay, so if I was talking, depending on where they're at, what their mental orientation is, their intellectual orientation, I would start questioning, like, have you thought about where that model comes from? Do you know the history of that approach, right? It's like, dude, it's not about managing symptoms. It's about, I agree, happiness, as we generally use that term, is very superficial, because what we generally mean is pleasure in the body.
Yes.
And what I'm talking about, equanimity and awareness, is a unconditional acceptance and love for whatever is occurring in the body, even pain. Mm-hmm. So that even I can feel pain come up. Oh my God, I'm so happy to be alive. This is uncomfortable. Thank goodness I'm well aware that everything is changing and this won't last forever. Mm-hmm. And how interesting to see, how long will I be in pain? What is this pain showing me? Or even with pleasure, like, oh man, I've been in pain, so it's so nice that there's some pleasure. I know it's not going to last forever. Mm-hmm. And that's what I mean when I throw around that word happiness. It's something deeper. It's something more, you busted out some whole other.
Eudaimonia.
Okay, yeah, I don't even know. You're the philosopher here, so I don't know what that is, but it sounds cool. I'm going to learn about it.
Thank you.
I'm going to call it presence.
That's
I'm going to call it, yeah. Presence, peace. Mm-hmm. It's something more like contentment. It's very close that you know that you're in that place when naturally, without needing to force it or override yourself, you feel compassion first towards yourself and then towards others. And then eventually it becomes not only easy, but automatic to act out of compassion.
Right. You don't need to have an app on your phone.
No.
In order to get there, which again, it becomes part of the industrialized component of mental health care. We continue to keep people trapped on that conveyor belt of, you just need to keep moving forward and we'll fill you with these things to keep you moving forward. And that's why I keep coming back to, and if you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. My guest today is R. Costello. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875 if you dare to dive in to the philosophical pool in which you're swimming. But I want to bridge that growth piece from my generation, right? I started this saying, I don't want to have my grandmother's attitude lamenting, oh, my poor grandchildren, their life will never be as beautiful as mine was because the world is, you know, falling apart. I want to be on the edge of the saying, come forward, my children, because there is unfoldings that I will never be a part of, but you're going to enjoy. And my job is to make sure you have the presence, the ability to be there for what comes to you and not be crippled by old cultural stories that were built to keep us limited, like a mental health care industry that keeps us continuously feeling like we're broken or sick or can't function. Like, that is the call that I'm feeling more and more, is to be on the edge of this precipice and then to pull my next generations forward and say, I've got you.
Yeah.
This is good. You'll be okay.
There
you are safe. Go forward.
Yes.
Instead of saying, oh no.
Yeah. Right. I believe in you. I love you. I'm excited for what happens. Right. I'm confident in your ability to handle whatever comes your way, even if it's not what you expected or if it's scary. Yeah, I mean, that's so beautiful. I know you're a mother and a grandmother, and I know you practice this every single day. And I know you're also a, I'll say, care provider and a teacher, a literal teacher. And so I see you doing the work, and to make it very concrete for any elders or young elders who are concerned about how do I walk in a good way with this upcoming generation, it's like, well, what are you doing to cultivate presence in yourself? Yes. What are you crippled by?
Yes.
And do you have... You know, how can you heal yourself so that when you model, when you walk, they don't mimic your limp?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking literally. You
no,
know what I mean?
I get that metaphor. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Right? How is your fear preventing your next future generations from thriving? How is your own limitations preventing your legacy from leading the next generations forward?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And knowing and seeing how like that leads to suffering, right? Because there's disconnect there. Anytime that you look at, when I look at my younger cousins and I'm like, oh, I don't know what's going to happen. Like, oh my God, what are you going to do? Dude, it doesn't feel good to me. I'm suffering. Mm-hmm. And I'm suffering because somewhere in there, and I might not know where or why yet, but somewhere in there, I have some craving for things to happen in a way that I could predict
and control
and understand, or I have an aversion to having to witness them experience mm-hmm. something that I experienced in the past that I haven't processed yet.
Exactly. Or that was painful to go through and I don't want to experience that again.
Yes.
Then it's kind of this game of chicken too for the parents of teenagers at this point, because they're right in that break. They're in that break point of everyone went to college. That's what the successful people did. We all go to college. And a lot of parents are going, yeah, but trade school, having something concrete they can do that gives them pride, right, and pleasure, and that they can own that they've built. It's like, that's really what we how long have we been saying that? That gives people a sense of belonging and purpose. I can make things, do things with my hands that help the culture. And yet no parental generation of the last, 10, 15 years wants to be the first one to say, yeah, we're not going to do college. We're going to do trade school. Like everyone's still a little too afraid for their child's future to allow that break to happen.
Right.
To free that child from having to follow the conveyor belt of, we promise you it'll work. Even though it didn't quite work for me, I think it'll work for you story.
And yeah.
That's a hellacious burden to put on your children and grandchildren. I think it might have worked for me. I don't think I'm happy though. But I think if you try harder, you'll do better than I did.
Like,
that's not a promise of the future.
No, I mean, underneath that, you can hear, right, in the language of that there's still this clinging. Mm-hmm. There's still this unwillingness to be with the absolute non-negotiable uncertainty of being in a human body that's dying. And
Now we're going to existential.
No, I'm just that's it. We'll just go to the edge right there. But
okay.
But right, it's I see in how you live your life that this is how you practice, that it's not about the parent deciding we're going to do trade school to the teenager.
Yes.
It's the parent resting, healing their own wounding so that they're not crippled, so that when they walk, they have an even gait and they stand up tall and all that metaphorically speaking. And so when they come to the teenager, they really are coming with an energy of love, compassion, and humility to listen, mm-hmm. to listen and to be able to reflect to that teenager a vision of themselves that they may not be able to connect to, because they're not quite, that's what parents are and elders and older cousins and aunties are here for, is to say, hey, you're rad, you know what I mean, like you're so talented, what is your and this is my practice as a leadership coach. I love to work with young people. They usually can't pay me money, so that's what are you gonna do about that? But I love to work with them, and really that's the knife's edge of my practice, because it really tests my humility, is really, can I listen and can I support them in getting curious about what are their goals? Mm-hmm. If they didn't have any constraints, if they weren't being driven by fear, what would they like their life to look like? Not how much money do you want? Not what career path should you take? How would you like to be living in 10 years? Mm-hmm. Well, just describe that to me. Maybe you want to be on the moon. Okay, well, we better start taking math. You know what I mean? But
right, because there are the concrete steps. It's not about kumbaya and living in a field and just hoping that money falls on you. And
yeah.
I think that's the part where we also get into trouble, is that there's one, we're binary. It's like you're either going to go and make money and be practical and do the things that we were told will work,
right,
or you're a flake.
Right.
And your mental health is, ruining you. It's like, it's so binary. And then so how to make it all of those things that I can feel all of these feelings. You know, I can want to feel purpose and have a meaningful life. And I also know that I get up and I do meaningful work, right? Whatever that meaningful work looks like. I tend to my neighbor's yard. I work for, you know, there has to be, I think, both things. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And Lisa, thanks for giving us a call.
Oh, thanks for this conversation. This is outstanding. I just want to make a super quick comment, and yet I feel it's a huge issue for me. They're just not present at all. Mm-hmm. They've got their earbuds in. They're on their phone. They don't even make eye contact when they're talking to you. Mm-hmm. I'm terrified for them, no matter what they do in their life. Mm-hmm. They're not even paying attention. I look at them walking by, and I'm like, you don't even know what the sound of these trees rustling sounds like. Mm-hmm. You might miss somebody that... How many people are you not knowing in your life past because you're not even looking up? It just terrifies me.
I hear that.
And thank you so much for this conversation. It's amazing.
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you for calling in. And I do hear that fear. And again, that kind of poises the next piece of this is, and Lisa, I know because you've called before that you are someone that's looking the kids in the eye and reminding them to speak up. Like we all, as the elders, have that job and that role to be that person, and we can, because here's the thing, kids can want whatever they want. Kids can have their preferences. Oh, I'm not going to do that. I don't feel like going to this, but they don't know anything because they have no life experience. And so it is our job as the elders to give them life experience, to expose them to things so that they have the understanding that there are options. And that's, I think, you know, to me, the most critical piece is that we can't give over our influence as the adults in the room. Mm-hmm. And just say, well, we can't control them, or they have their earbuds on, or we can't get them to pay attention, or we can't get them to want to do anything. They're always going to say no because they only know this little tiny world. If we don't expose our children to all of the ways of experiencing life, things that are hard and challenging and fun and exciting and new and different, then that's on us. Then we failed to provide for them an opportunity to see a different future because we abdicated our job as adults in the room to provide opportunities for a future that they can grow into. And unfortunately, that's our hour. Ara Costello, thank you so much for being my guest today. This has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you can be part of the conversation by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. Podcast the show if you really want to be mod. And thank you always for being a part of our community. Thank you. I really enjoy our conversations.
It was so fun. I'm so happy to be here.
We'll do it again soon.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in and listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Some people say life's like a merry-go-round. I think it's more